The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, a weekly podcast covering the federal courts of appeal. I'm your host, John Ross, joined today by Evan Burnick and Clark Neely of the Institute for Justice's Center for Judicial Engagement. If you enjoy the podcast, be sure to subscribe to our email newsletter that provides brief and sometimes irreverent summaries of the week's action in the federal circuits. To subscribe, go to ij/short-circuit. This week on the show, conflict minerals from the Congo, the FTC comes down hard on a hotel chain, and a bomb-throwing SWAT team. Clark, kick us off.
Yeah, so the first case out of the D.C. Circuit involves a question that's been tying the D.C. Circuit up in knots and about which the Supreme Court will almost certainly have to step in to provide guidance, and that is whether there are any meaningful First Amendment limits on the government's ability to force companies to make whatever disclosures the government thinks they should make. And we're not talking here about things like, side effects for a drug or information that if you don't have it could be harmful. Just things people might be curious about, like in this case, whether particular minerals have been found to be conflict-free, meaning they come from a country in Africa where there is or isn't certain political conflicts. This is also going on with genetically modified crops and any number of other issues. Comes down to one thing. Can the government force a company to make disclosures not to prevent people from being harmed, but just because some people might be curious about that information?
Okay, Evan, what's going on in the case?
Okay, so this case involves Dodd-Frank. It is a federal law that regulates, among other things, securities that are issued for various products. And this particular rule requires that issuers of securities that have products with materials that are taken from zones in the Democratic Republic of the Congo that are designated not conflict-free by the governments need to reveal that information. Essentially, they compel the companies in question to speak about a hotly contested, controversial issue in a way that conveys a moral taint.
So what's the purpose of the law, Clark?
Well, that's a good question. The government was somewhat vague on that point, but the gist of it is basically that the government thinks it provides, quote unquote, overall social benefits for people to be able to know whether products they're buying that have certain minerals in them. And just in case anybody's curious, the conflict minerals in question here are gold, tin, tantalum, and tungsten. Tantalum apparently is used in medical implants, and tungsten is used in light bulbs, x-rays, and military projectiles. So basically, these are the kinds of materials we're talking about. The government just thinks some people might be interested in knowing whether they come from a conflict-free zone or not, and so it forces people who deal in these minerals to make that disclosure. And the question, again, is whether it violates the First Amendment to force a company to make a disclosure that is not about preventing consumer harm, but simply disclosing information the government thinks that some people might be curious to know.
And what did the D.C. Circuit say?
The D.C. Circuit said that it violated the First Amendment. It pointed out that Congress's aim, stated aim, was to reduce a humanitarian crisis, and there was nothing even resembling reliable evidence that compelling these companies to disclose this information actually alleviated any humanitarian crisis. In fact, there's evidence that suggests it has the opposite effect. And the D.C. Circuit said you can't rely upon conjecture and speculation when you're compelling people to speak.
And that actually is an important point, because so much of constitutional litigation comes down to that question. Must the government support its coercive policies, in other words, policies that require people to act in a way they would rather not? Must the government have actual evidence to support forcing people to do things, or can it force people to do things merely on the basis of speculation and conjecture? The government, of course, wants to be able to act on the basis of speculation and conjecture, as it is arguing in this case. But when you have real judicial review, judicial engagement, that requires that the government prove its factual assertions with evidence. It's unable to do that in this case, and that's why it's arguing for speculation or conjecture as the relevant standard.
Evan, do you want to talk a little bit more about how the humanitarian purpose for the law is not quite being fulfilled? Do we know more about that?
Right. So the idea is that if you compel these companies to disclose this information, you will discourage people from buying these securities, and therefore you will undermine the economic base of the rebels that are controlling these conflict-ridden areas. The problem is that when you discourage people, and this does discourage people, from investing in these regions, you can have unintended unintended consequences, namely that you force people to depend upon, local people to depend upon these rebel forces for their financial support, for their livelihood. You encourage them to crack down harder on the population in order to get resources out of them than you would if you had investment by outside parties in the region.
Okay, let's move on to the next case, which comes out of the Third Circuit. Evan?
This case involves an FTC action against Wyndham, which is a hotel chain that allegedly has really, really, really shoddy cybersecurity practices and exposed a lot of customer information to three separate cyber attacks that resulted in the loss of millions of dollars. The FTC is charging that Wyndham engaged in unfair practices, and the question in this case is whether Wyndham had fair notice that they would be held accountable on the basis of the standard that the FTC applied.
Well, Clark, let's back up and let's hear more about the shoddy security practices. You might even call them Babytown frolics.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's important to remember that this is up on a motion to dismiss, so all we have here are the FTC's allegations. Nothing has been proven. But what the FTC alleges is that Wyndham had really shockingly low standards for cybersecurity, including an absence of firewalls, the use of the same word for login and for password, lack of encryption files for sensitive customer information like credit card numbers. I mean, really, really jaw-dropping stuff. And, of course, if that's proven, then at least in a civil proceeding from the customers who lost money, one would think they could recover. But the question in this case is different. The question in this case is twofold. It's first, whether the Federal Trade Commission has statutory authority to regulate companies in terms of their use or non-use of cybersecurity. That's the unfairness prong that Evan mentioned earlier. And the second question is whether the FTC's persistent failure to articulate standards for cybersecurity fails to provide companies with the notice that they are required to have as a matter of due process in order to know what standard they have to conform to. And that's a very real argument. I mean, it seems that whatever if the allegations against Wyndham are true, then whatever the standard is, they've surely not met it. But there's a lot of other companies out there that are left in the lurch wondering just how much should we devote by way of resources to our cybersecurity, and they are completely in the dark because the FTC simply refuses to articulate a position so that companies can know, okay, this is what's expected of you from a cybersecurity standpoint. That's pretty concerning.
And so has the Third Circuit ordered the FTC to provide more guidance?
No, quite the opposite. In fact, it's issued a decision in this case that actually encourages the FTC not to provide guidance by holding that to the extent that the FTC doesn't have a direct adjudication on points or doesn't issue an interpretive rule, the standards of fair notice of what the FTC might do and hold you accountable for are actually less than they would be if the FTC issued an interpretive rule or had an adjudication that was directly on point.
I have to add one thing. This case is a bit rich. You got the federal government going after companies for lax data security practices at the exact same time that we know, for example, that the Secretary of State was conducting all of her official business on an apparently unsecured personal server. We also know that another agency, the IRS, has lost massive quantities of emails and other data that were under subpoena. They've lost hard drives. They've lost personal BlackBerries. And it's not just the IRS. It's not just the State Department. What is quite clear here is that the FTC is attempting to hold private companies to a standard that is orders of magnitude more stringent than the standards to which the federal government holds itself. And that would be shocking if it weren't so routine. In other words, for the government to create a double standard where it expects far more of private individuals than the standards to which it holds itself, that is so routine these days as to be almost completely unexceptional. Unexceptional, but it is exceptionable because it's wrong.
Okay, now the next case, which comes out of the Seventh Circuit. Clark?
So this is yet another case of police militarization. In this particular case, it involves an 11-member, heavily armed SWAT team forcing its way into a home occupied by an older woman and her two teenage daughters in order to, in response to threats that had been made against the police over an unsecured Wi-Fi network. And just to give away the end of the case, not by anybody living in the house, but by somebody who had logged on from outside the house, something the police could have determined had they bothered to conduct any investigation attention whatsoever before kicking their way through the door and tossing flashbangs into the windows, which, of course, they didn't bother to do.
Tell us a little bit more about the raid, Evan.
Yeah, this is a full-scale raid. You have 11 SWAT officers, all armed, throwing in flashbangs into a house and accompanied by a local news team, incidentally, marching out both this elderly woman and her daughter in handcuffs outside of the house.
Clark, what's a flashbang?
Well, flashbang is a grenade that police will toss into a building that they're raiding. It goes off with a very, very bright light and a loud bang, but it's also an incendiary device. And as Judge Posner points out in the opinion, it can be lethal, for example, if it goes off close enough to somebody. He notes that the police call them distraction devices, which Posner correctly describes as an absurd euphemism, and notes that the Seventh Circuit has referred to them as bombs before. Unfortunately, practice makes clear that some police departments throw these things around like Mardi Gras beads and will toss them basically into any building or home, no matter who's in there. And there have been a number of tragic incidents, including one in Georgia, where a SWAT team threw a flashbang grenade through a window. It landed in a crib next to a sleeping two-year-old and almost burned him to death. Of course, in that case, the SWAT team took no responsibility whatsoever and still refuses to pay the family's medical bills, despite the fact that they found nothing inside the house. So this is another example of the police essentially treating American citizens as an occupying force or acting as an occupying force, treating American citizens as enemies, performing no minimal investigation to make sure that they conduct this raid safely. It is a disgraceful example of over-militarization and irresponsibility on the part of the police, and the Seventh Circuit correctly rejects the police department's absurd or the police officer's absurd attempt to invoke qualified immunity.
Well, back to the issue of the minimal investigation, it turns out that the guy that they actually wanted was watching the raid from two doors away. Evan?
Yeah, he was right next door, and the police were on notice of this guy who had actually made threats to the police in the past. Turns out, what do you know? He's actually the guy who was responsible for the threats. He was charged and convicted, and oh, by the way, just to go back on the raid earlier, when they arrested this guy, they didn't send in a SWAT team. There were no local news cameras, nothing like that, and there were no flashbangs. They invited him to come to the station.
Clark, can you tell us a little more about why the Seventh Circuit rejected qualified immunity?
Well, I mean, when you look at this, the totality of circumstances, the complete indifference to the safety of the people in the house, the complete failure to perform even a basic investigation to try to determine who really made the threats, who was at home, whether they were armed, et cetera, and there's even case law specific to SWAT raids and the use of flashbang grenades, and the police have to make at least some effort to ensure that they're not putting innocent lives at risk, which they very much did in this case, or they failed to make that effort. There's even, just to show the complete disregard these police had for the safety of the people in the house, there's even a line in the opinion about how at least they did remember to bring a fire extinguisher to the raid, but then they left it in the SWAT vehicle, so it wasn't even on hand in case they had started a fire and needed to put it out. So for all of those reasons, and basically for the complete indifference that the police showed to the safety of these innocent people and the utter lack of professionalism with which they conducted this raid and the risks that they created, that's why qualified immunity was denied. And I should just add, we've had a decades-long experiment led in large measure by the Supreme Court of withholding, almost completely withholding accountability from law enforcement. It's time to end that experiment. We hold doctors who make stupid decisions under stressful circumstances liable for their conduct, the same with every other vocation, from pilots to truck drivers. There's absolutely no reason why police should be let off the hook when they are negligent in the manner these police were. And the other thing that needs to be ended is the policy of indemnifying police officers who engage in this fashion. There's an article, a Law Review article out from last year that documents that 99.98% of judgments against police officers in situations like this are paid for by their employers. That's ridiculous. That's bad public policy, and that should stop too.
All right. Well, thanks for listening. Be sure to follow Clark and Evan on Twitter for more judicial engagement. Their handles are @ConLawWire and @EvanBurnick. And again, you can subscribe to the email newsletter at ij.org/short-circuit. Until next time, this is John Ross from the Institute for Justice begging, down on bended knee, for you to get engaged.